The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney.
The real outperformance has been the U.S. corporate high yield.
Are the companies lean enough? Have they trimmed all the fat?
The semiconductor business is a really cyclical business.
Breaking market headlines and corporate news from across the globe.
Do investors like the M&A that we've seen?
These are two big time blue chip companies.
The window between the peak and cut changing super fast.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney. On Bloomberg Radio.
On today's Bloomberg Intelligence Show, we dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
Today, we'll discuss why Apple's iPhone shipments are falling in China.
Plus, we'll look at Boeing's leadership overhaul with CEO David Calhoun stepping down at the end of 2024.
But first, Robinhood Markets, best known for offering commission-free trading, is rolling out a credit card to U.S. consumers as it looks to become a broader financial services company.
The Robinhood Gold Card will be offered exclusively to members of the firm's subscription-based gold program.
For more, guest host Bailey Lipschultz and I were joined by Robinhood co-founder and CEO Vlad Tenev. We first asked him for more context on the company's latest news.
We were really excited to announce this. We've been working on it for quite a while, and we didn't just want to launch another Me Too credit card. We really wanted to come in and do something special and really lead the industry. So it's really the best cashback rewards that we found in any credit card on the market, the best digital experience, and really the best design. We have a solid gold card that's basically a hunk of metal. It's extremely iconic, very simple, like very well designed. We're really proud of the product.
How does the credit card fit into the business? Because I know early last year you guys announced a retirement product, so it feels like you're trying to expand away from the core trading platform.
Yeah, so as a business, holistically, we're focused on three things. The first is being the number one platform for active traders. Right now we're number two, but we have a path to being number one in some number of years. And that's really through user experience improvements, product innovations like 24-hour market, adding new asset classes like futures, new platform launches like our Web Pro platform, which we've announced. But we don't want to just be an active trader platform. We also want to grow wallet share with our customers and help them build wealth. And that's where Robinhood Gold comes in. That's where our innovations in the retirement program with the 3% match come in. And of course, now the credit card is sort of another pillar of us growing wallet share with customers and helping them do all of their financial activities in one place via Robinhood.
So are you competing with this card with the bank-issued Visa and MasterCards? Is that the market you're now going into?
I think that we're trying to do something really interesting with this card. So if you think about premium credit cards,
yep,
the best ones out there accept less than half of the people that apply.
Is that right?
So yeah,
is that a Chase Sapphire or is that an Amex Platinum or whatever?
Those classes of credit cards, really like the typical sort of like super prime premium rewards cards, and they have high annual fees.
Right.
So what we wanted to do is, in the same way that Robinhood democratized stock trading,
yep,
and made it accessible to a wider group of people, we want to open up the private client experience. I don't know if you've been to a Chase branch, mm-hmm, but you can see there's two doors, one for the private clients,
yep,
and one for everyone else. And the whole idea behind Robinhood Gold is giving that private client experience for as little as $5 a month, opening it to everyone. And it starts with the premium credit card. Of course, the retirement benefits where you get a 3% match, the first and biggest in the industry, the 5% APY on our cash, which is just a institutional grade high yield offering that you have to have, you know, millions of dollars to match at other brokers. So yeah, we're putting all this together and we're seeing Robinhood Gold customers actually depositing the lion's share of their money into Robinhood and really growing with us. And I think we have an opportunity to offer them services for all of their financial needs.
And Vlad, the perks are pretty sweet. As you mentioned, 3% cash back on all purchases. Do you make money off of this? How is this going to be kind of another peg for the profitability and the growth of the company?
Yeah, two things there. One is we do, obviously, any business line we enter, we intend to be profitable over the long run on a standalone basis. So not just accretive, but we anticipate this being a profitable business line just within the card portfolio. And that's through not just the interchange transaction revenue, but also the lending business through the card. We anticipate this would actually be a very attractive card for people building credit over time and not just folks that pay off their balance in full. The other side of it is we see that when customers adopt Robinhood Gold, their rate of deposit growth and account balance growth is much higher than non-Gold customers. They also adopt our products at a much higher rate. And so even though they're getting so much more value with all of these industry-leading rates and value props, the revenue that accrues to the business from the Gold relationship is also multiples higher than non-Gold customers. And we think the credit card, since it's so core to people's financial needs, typically all of the lion's share of their spending goes through credit. And if you're using a credit card, much easier to grab the paycheck deposit.
Sweeney carries cash around, though. This is a guy who walks around with hundreds of dollars in his pocket. I don't know why.
I ask myself the same. When you walk into a bar, the Jersey Shore, you put good cash on the bar there. All right, so who is the typical Robinhood customer these days, client these days?
A typical Robinhood customer, I would say, is someone in their 30s.
Okay.
They tend to be an early adopter of technology. They have, you know, more half of our customers make over $100,000 in annual income. So it's not sort of like the paycheck to paycheck customer as maybe some people think.
Yep.
And we also have much larger customers with big accounts. We recently have been introducing matches. In fact, we rolled out another initiative, 1% unlimited deposit match into Robinhood for all dollars deposited for our Gold members. So basically, most financial firms charge you a percentage to keep your money there as a management fee. We're paying you a percentage to move your money with us. And these types of offers have really attracted people with much bigger accounts. We've had customers with tens of millions of dollars moving those accounts to Robinhood, and they've been very happy with the experience. So we have been adding capabilities to serve customers across the entire market, not just sort of in that middle tier, but also people with more money and people with less who are just getting started. We also would like to serve them and have been focusing on that demographic since day one.
And Vlad, when I talk to skeptics, they point out that you guys are heavily reliant on options trading, crypto volumes, and that driving the business. Paul mentioned the huge run-up over the last 12 months, still down 48% from the IPO price. What is the kind of mission in the next coming months and years for the company to get back to that IPO price and trade higher?
Well, I think we've been doing really well focusing on the inputs of the business. I can't really control the stock price directly, but if we're growing revenues, if we're diversifying revenues, if we're launching innovative new products for our customers, I think we can kind of grow through market headwinds and high interest rate environment and be sort of like a company that thrives in all conditions. And you mentioned the revenues and, you know, options trading and all of these things, but what's happened in the past couple of years is the revenue profile of the business has diversified as we've rolled out all these products. As of the last earnings report, several earnings calls, more than half of the revenue is actually net interest margin, not even transaction based.
Right.
So as we add more of these products, like the 5% yield on your cash, the profile of the business has also changed.
Our thanks to Robinhood co-founder and CEO Vlad Tenev.
We move now to politics. President Joe Biden has gained ground against Republican Donald Trump in 6 of the 7 key swing states, and significantly so in at least 2 of them. The results make for the Democrats' strongest position yet in a monthly Bloomberg News Morning Consult poll.
For more on this poll, we were joined by Mark Niket, Bloomberg Real Economy team reporter. We first asked Mark to break down some of the poll's findings.
The poll shows, it's a monthly tracking poll that we've been doing since October, and it shows that Trump's still doing pretty well in Georgia, Arizona, Nevada. But the most significant findings is that Biden has improved his standing in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, sort of the blue wall. I think these states are going to decide the election, and he needs to win these states if he's going to get a second term. In Wisconsin, Biden now holds a one-point lead over Trump after trailing him by 4 points in February. In Pennsylvania, the candidates are tied after Trump had a 6-point lead in February, and they're also tied in Michigan.
Any common denominator here, Mark, as to what might be driving some of these poll numbers?
The timing of the poll was interesting. It was conducted March 8th through the 15th in the swing states. And March 8th is a day after Biden's State of the Union address, which was pretty fiery and I think, you know, alleviated some Democratic concerns about the president's age and his fitness to take on Trump a second time in a rematch. And it's also midway about March 12th is Super Tuesday when both Biden and Trump sort of clinch the respective nominations. They got enough delegates to clinch. So it kind of really made it a binary choice. You know, we knew this was going to be the outcome, but I think the Democrats in particular were thinking that until it was really clear in voters' minds that this was going to be a rematch and it was Trump or Biden, that's their choices, that, you know, Biden was not going to do as well in the polls. Mm-hmm. So this is sort of the first poll that, you know, we have clearly established that it's going to be a Trump-Biden rematch.
Are voters voting because they like the candidates or because they don't like the other one?
Well, interestingly, our poll showed that in the case of Trump, most of the support is coming from people who like Trump. Only 3 in 10 Trump supporters said they were voting for Trump because they didn't like Biden. They're essentially voting against Biden. But the case was different for Biden. About half the supporters of Biden said they were voting for the president essentially as a vote against Trump. They didn't want to see Trump get back into the White House. And it was even more pronounced in Wisconsin, where like 6 in 10 of the supporters of Biden were voting for him because they were voting against Trump.
To that point, are those voters more sticky or not? Like, is the anti-vote stickier than the pro-vote?
Well, this is what we're going to find out, is what's more motivating, right? Support for your candidate or desire not to see the other candidate win. You know, I think Trump has benefited over time from enthusiastic support from his base and base turning out to support for him. But the negative feeling can also be a very strong motivating factor, could drive folks to the polls specifically to vote against Donald Trump because they don't want to see him back in the White House. We're going to find out what's more motivating, you know, voting for your guy or voting against the other guy.
All right. Great stuff. Really appreciate it. Thank you very much. We look forward to the next poll as well. Mark Niket, he's Bloomberg Real Economy reporter, joining us in the latest morning console poll.
Coming up on the program, we'll discuss why Apple's iPhone shipments are falling in China. You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. And this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Listen on demand wherever you get your podcasts or watch us live on YouTube.
We look next at the aerospace industry and Boeing. Earlier this week, we got news that Boeing CEO Dave Calhoun is stepping down at the end of this year. It's all part of a leadership overhaul.
This comes as a plane maker has been dealing with the aftermath of a near catastrophic fuselage failure on a 737 MAX 9 aircraft early this year.
Boeing also said that Chairman Larry Kellner will not stand for re-election, and Stan Deal, chief of Boeing's commercial airplane division, is departing. He'll be replaced by Chief Operating Officer Stephanie Pope.
For more, we're joined by George Ferguson, Bloomberg Intelligence senior aerospace analyst. We first asked George for his reaction to the news.
My reaction was, you know, I think we thought Dave Calhoun probably would be going. I hate to sort of wish that on anybody, but it seemed that, you know, the problems in the manufacturing business just There were just too many of them over too long a period of time to say that he was as effectual, if that's a right word, as he should have been at bringing everything, you know, back into order. It does seem weird that it's going to take them till the end of 2024 to find his replacement. There's a lot of things that have to happen between now and then that the company just can't wait for. They've got to serve to the FAA their view on how they're going to stabilize their production process. And at the same time, right, they've got to start to increase build rates so they can improve profits and cash flow. They can't wait a year on that either. So there's a lot of super important things that are happening this year. To wait till the end of the year to replace a CEO that doesn't seem to have been able to get that job done well, it seems like a lengthy timeline to me, but it may just be that the board was flat-footed in realizing that the CEO had to go and is nowhere in a search, and so they've got to start from scratch here and figure out who the next person is.
What can you tell us about Stephanie Pope? She's going to be stepping up and taking a bigger role with the aircraft business.
Yeah, so she's been around for a while, and she's been the CFO of that aircraft business. So it seems like a logical inside choice, but I think when you have a head of that department, Stan Deal, who's leaving after 30 plus years at the company, they're hard shoes to fill. You look around internally for who could be the next person. The CFO is always in particularly decent shape because they understand at least all the financials about the business. She's also had positions at Boeing Global Services, which is a super successful business inside Boeing, high teens margins. To me, the only thing I don't see in her background is that manufacturing skill set. Mm-hmm. I think the next CEO has to really have a manufacturing engineering mindset background. And I think that's what I don't quite see there.
Sort of like a Larry Culp?
Larry obviously is pretty busy. And honestly, the job he has now at GE could be better profits, more fun than Boeing, because there's a lot of great technology inside GE, and there's a huge bow wave of a lot of maintenance coming that's really high margin. I think you'd really have to work hard to get Larry
Culp
out of
there. But George, I mean, does he like fun or does he like a challenge? I mean, he was the one that went to GE to begin with.
I do think he likes a challenge, and I think he showed his ability to navigate it really well at GE. But again, they're just kind of getting to the super fun part. I think there's still challenge inside GE, but he's just getting to the point where he's got aerospace broken out and he can really make a lot of hay here. So someone like him is absolutely what I think Boeing needs. I don't know, maybe he's got maybe there's a protege somewhere inside there that they could tap or something.
Thinking about who could be the next CEO here, is the expectation, George, that it'll come from an external candidate or internally? And are there any early front runners, do you think?
Yeah, so I definitely think it's going to come external, right? I just think the fact that you've seen this purge of the CEO, you see the purge of commercial airplane president, means that we depleted some talent there. There was, former heads of Boeing's commercial airplanes that had left when Muhlenberg came on. They could potentially be, in the running for something like this. I know a couple of them wanted the CEO job and didn't get it. But I'm almost positive you're talking about something that's going to be outside. Ray Conner's the name that comes to mind. Used to be the head of Boeing Commercial. I'm not sure what he's doing now, but he might be on the list somewhere.
What's the culture like at a Boeing in terms of getting an outsider?
You know, I think Boeing is one of those companies, I think you get a job and you stick around for lots and lots of years. And so, I think that bringing people in from outside is something you do only when you have a breakdown like you've had now, right? Under normal circumstances, there would be very clean lines of succession inside Boeing. You would move up through the ranks and expect opportunities as you rose. But there's been so much tumult in this business over the last, 4 years or so, that I think that it's a time in their history where they're going to be going outside a lot more to replenish some of these senior management ranks. So they've turned over a bunch of it.
And George, it seems like this is no quick fix here. It seems like it was years, maybe even decades in the making in terms of maybe the deterioration of some of their quality controls here. When you talk to industry folks, people at Boeing, is there a pathway to kind of get back to where they were in terms of quality?
I think there is, but it's a lot of attention to detail. And like you said, it's slow work. So you can't sort of wave a wand, I think, and make it happen overnight. Really, I think it has a lot to do with people and processes, right? And that's why I think you want someone like a Larry Culp who loves people and processes. You need, and that just takes time. You need a lot more You need training. You need to, in the interim, you probably need to beef up some of the oversight. You need to get into your supply chain. You need to give them a hug. You need to help them out, help them bring you quality products. It's not a, hey, how are you going to make my margins work better in the next couple of years discussion, right? It's really, like I said, it's people and processes. It's the softer side of management. I think Boeing over the last decade or two really was more into the, how do I squeeze you to get, you to give me products at a cheaper price so I can build my margins, recipe for success. It wasn't, that wasn't quite the term, but there was a term like that that Boeing was using with their suppliers. And it was all about squeezing them. So the supply chain is all, they've been scarred. They're worried about when Boeing comes to talk to them. And I think they need to get to a world where when Boeing shows up, they think someone's there to help them and is looking out for their best interests.
Our thanks to George Ferguson, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Aerospace Analyst.
We move next to big tech and Apple. Earlier in the week, we reported that Apple iPhone shipments in China fell about 33% in February from a year earlier, and that's citing data from the China Academy of Information and Communications Technology.
For more on this, we were joined by Mandeep Singh, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Tech Analyst. We first asked Mandeep why he thinks China iPhone shipments are falling.
Clearly, they have a problem both with the demand for iPhone as well as competition. I think one of the things that doesn't get as much attention right now is the fact that Huawei has a comparable phone to iPhone. And the reason they have been able to do it very quickly is because of the supply chains that Apple created in the region. So a lot of those suppliers are actually making the phone for Huawei. And they don't have to do much because Apple is at the cutting edge when it comes to the chip, the assembly. And so all the supply chains guys are actually diversifying themselves and making phones for Xiaomi, Huawei. Huawei is the notable share gainer here, but that just goes to show that, they are also diversifying.
I don't know the answer. I can't think of an answer for Apple, particularly on the supply chain. I can pencil out China going to close to zero in terms of sales. I could pencil that out, put a multiple on it, and there we go. There is no Apple without China in terms of supply chain. There is no Apple without that supply chain.
And for the longest time, we thought the risk for the suppliers is if Apple is not giving business to them, they don't have anything to manufacture. Well, guess what? They have, Huawei and the local guys. And so that's how they are going about the business right now.
So if I'm Tim Cook and I have seen this for years and I want to diversify my supply chain, what does that look like? What is that?
I mean, we did a big report. It's a multi-year.
Of course you did.
Yes, the assembly part is already moving to India. We've seen a big ramp up in India, almost 22% of the phones last year, iPhones, not the highest end, but a lot of the models were assembled in India. And gradually they will have to diversify, the assembly side. The problem they are running into is all the components that you need to manufacture an iPhone and the complex device that it is, it's not that easy to just, lift and shift your supply chains into a different regions. There are so many dependencies, both with TSMC and the other suppliers that feed into the Chinese assembly. So all that needs to be relocated, and it will happen. It's just, it's a multi-year effort. And right now the focus is also shifting towards on-device AI. I feel the reason why the Chinese government is really cracking down is because the next wave of this is AI will run on device, and they don't want a US-based company probably to be running AI on device in the region. So that's the other aspect of it.
A bear case could be made here. Long-term, multi-year bear case here. I've got supply chain issues. I've already zeroed out my China revenue.
And services revenue is going to be changing because of all the new laws, right, in terms of court cases?
Could be.
Yeah, the DOJ lawsuit, it's coming at the worst time for Apple. I mean, they should be doubling down on other markets where they can acquire share that they may end up losing in China. Obviously, the DOJ lawsuit is not helping, and the EU regulation, the Digital Markets Act. So from a regulatory perspective, you're right. I think the bear case is really around the revenue exposure, and I'm sure the supply chains they'll muddle through in terms of making sure they can still make the phone. And, as long as the manufacturers over there are getting the business, they don't mind Apple continuing to, have the supply chains remain intact there. But I think the hard part would be the EPS drawdown as a result of the Chinese revenue going down.
Why can't they just build stuff in the U.S.? Like, I know it's not as easy as, like, here's a plant, let's plop it down in the U.S. But, like, why is India the next port of call? Like, why not the U.S.?
Well, again, it's the components. So think of the bill of... Yeah, you. There are certain components that can only be sourced over there. And over time, they can move things around. But if you're talking about a $1,200 phone, it has a certain bill of materials, things are done in a certain way, that's why it comes at that cost. We're not talking about a $5,000 phone.
Do you remember when the iPhone was coming out at $1,000 and it was like, no one's going to pay that, this right. is insane, this is ridiculous, and now it's like $1,200, whatever.
Yeah, exactly. The market adapts, as we've seen here. All right, so if you're a bull, are you simply saying, there's 2 billion units out there, they'll figure out a way to make money off of those things, and that ecosystem.
Yeah, I mean, the bull case is still the ecosystem and the fact that they have an installed base of 1.3 billion users, you know, who still have the iPhone and they will refresh the phone at some point. And everyone still likes the iOS ecosystem. I think what Huawei is doing is laying out a path where people can move out of the iOS ecosystem. And then the whole AI thing and the regulatory stuff, I think, is just making it worse for the timing of it is just worse for Apple right now.
The developer conference in June, right? The pressure is going to be big for them to
deliver
something.
And remember, they're looking at leveraging Baidu now. The reason for leveraging Baidu for AI in Chinese region is just to please, you know, that the fact that they're using a local AI player as opposed to deploying their own AIs.
Our thanks to Mandeep Singh, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Tech Analyst.
Coming up on the program, a look at how Danish drug maker Novo Nordisk is expanding its treatment for cardiovascular disease.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele, and this is Bloomberg.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for the Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast. Catch us live weekdays at 10 a.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
We move now to the cruise operator Carnival. The company reporting first quarter revenue that beat analyst expectations. The company also raising its profit forecast for the year on record bookings volume, and this includes high demand for cruise vacations combined with cost management, including debt refinancing and repayment.
For more on this, we are joined by Jody Lurie, Bloomberg Intelligence credit analyst. We first asked for her take on Carnival's first quarter earnings.
I would say that when you look at Carnival, it's really a cash flow story. It really is a credit story more than anything else, and the bookings are sort of confirming that. Now, the booking level, if you include short and long term, it's actually not at the peak, which was second quarter of last year, but it's right near the peak. And based on what management is saying, it sounds like second quarter of this year might top second quarter of last year. That said, I think more importantly, the company is starting to attack some of its debt load, particularly in some of its secured areas, which will help to sort of free up the balance sheet a little bit, provide some flexibility, make it so that the company has an ability to sort of make its way back to high grade ratings as it's been targeting for 2026.
Yeah, Jody, you called that out. Just using the FA function on the terminal, Carnival Cruise, almost $32 billion in debt compared to a market cap of $21 billion. How does that stack up to the likes of Royal Caribbean or Norwegian and some of those other peers in the cruise liner space?
So yeah, Carnival was able to bring down their debt load to about $30 billion over the past year. And it's likely that it'll probably end this year around that level based on what they're taking in terms of ships. That said, it is significantly higher than Royal, it is significantly higher than Norwegian, but on a leverage perspective, it's sort of middle of the pack at the moment as compared to Royal and Norwegian. Royal is a few quarters ahead of Carnival in terms of its deleveraging strategy. Management at Royal actually bumped up their narrative around getting to investment grade level metrics to do it earlier than 2025. and Carnival stuck to that 2026 number, which I think is descriptive of being a little bit more conservative, particularly with the backdrop of everything happening globally, not just the Baltimore bridge situation, but also at the Red Sea and everywhere else that's affecting Carnival more broadly because of its more global nature.
I'm looking at, again, the FAA function, as Bailey called out. I still see, you know, $3, $4 billion in CapEx every year. Are they buying ships, or what are they spending that kind of money on?
Yeah, the $3, $4 billion of CapEx is primarily ship. There is a portion of it that is in terms of maintenance CapEx, right? Your ships get old, you have to update them every few years. You have all these sort of different requirements related to it. They also have that Celebration Key that they're rolling out on, which is on the Grand Bahama. And that's to rival their peers, which have been investing really heavily also into island presence, right? The Caribbean island presence is a moneymaker for all of them. It's this captive audience. They bring the people who are on their ships to these islands and to these sections of islands, like, you know, not the whole Grand Bahama, but that carved out section specifically for Carnival, and, you know, wine and dine them, get them to spend extra money. That onboard spend is really where you see that margin.
You mentioned wining and dining. I just want to look at some of the other areas that you cover, talking about Wynn Resorts, MGM, Hilton.
All the fun stuff.
All the fun stuff. Yeah, you have the best job. I hope you take advantage of it. But, like, when you look at the underlying business dynamics of some of the other areas that you cover, what are we seeing in terms of hotel demand and hotel sales and what that means from a credit perspective?
So hotel demands, hotel sales, it is a bit mixed regionally, but I think overall we're pretty optimistic about this year. And that's a function of the fact that business and conference is really picking up this year as compared to the past few years. You know, we're at that point where that post-pandemic narrative has sort of played out and we're getting to more normalized. That said, there are areas of expansion and growth. We're also seeing that all-inclusive area be a much more attractive area for a lot of these companies. And I think we are seeing some rivalry across the board when it comes to hotels, casinos, cruise lines as these destination opportunities. We're talking Las Vegas, obviously not the regional casinos, that's a little bit different. But Las Vegas, Macau, the cruise lines and the hotels, there's a lot of sort of this destination narrative that's going on to get people to spend that extra money and to sort of go on vacation, live life to the fullest. Now, we do have these partnerships that are happening between Marriott and MGM, but then also we have an MGM and Carnival relationship. So there is this fluidity that's happening within my industry that makes it sort of interesting.
And you get a great view on the consumer, Jody, with you know, the coverage you have, again, hotels and casinos and cruise lines. Where are people kind of spending their dollar? And it seems like they're still spending on that whole experiential thing, the experiences. What are the companies you cover? What are they saying as to the how that's likely to play out?
So consumers are definitely spending still on experiences. We're still very much seeing it. Now, if you compare 2023 to 2022, it's a different sort of narrative than 2023 to 2024 because the base is much greater, right? If you looked at the base going back to 2021, you're dealing with nothing. Building on nothing, it's very significant. That said, there still is that narrative of growth and that consumer spending on experiences. Where we sort of wonder is what's going to happen heading into the second half. That's sort of the puzzle piece that isn't quite filled out for us yet, where first half into the summer season is very strong. We're also seeing that for cruise lines. They're saying that going into 2025, they're seeing strength. And that's a function of the fact that people book their cruises so far in advance. You don't get that benefit in the hotel space. You don't get that benefit as much in the vacation arena elsewhere. People don't book vacations apart from cruises so far in advance. So I think as we head into second half, we'll sort of get a feel for how comfortable the consumer is in terms of spending.
Our thanks to Jody Lurie, Bloomberg Intelligence credit analyst.
We turn now to the drug space. Now, this week, we heard the Danish weight loss drug maker Novo Nordisk has agreed to buy Cardior Pharmaceuticals for up to $1.1 billion. This comes as soaring demand for obesity drugs continues to drive the more deal-making for Novo Nordisk.
For more, we were joined by Michael Shah, Bloomberg Intelligence senior pharma biotech analyst. We first asked him for some context on this deal.
The deal is very much in line with kind of Novo's strategic aspirations, which is to build, you know, a presence in the cardiovascular disease space. So prior deals that they've done include a deal with KBB, for a hypertension asset. A deal with Corvidia for zilcovetamab. So this is very much in line with that sort of play. In terms of, you know, the lead asset, there's a drug called CDR132L. So, you know, in simple terms, it's designed to block a biomarker of heart failure. What we see with current therapies is, you know, current therapies kind of slow disease progression, but they don't necessarily, you know, halt it or reverse it. And that's kind of what Novo is trying to do with this asset.
So they're trying to stop it altogether and reverse it?
Yeah.
Wow. That's amazing. How does this also fit into Novo's weight loss drug in that I remember speaking to the Novo Nordisk CEO and they're like really, really, really invested in like improving people's overall health. Like the weight loss drug isn't about losing weight. It's about relieving the pressure that it puts on the heart. It's about relieving diabetes. It's about the broader stuff. How do these two work together?
Could potentially add to Novo's cardiovascular portfolio. So, I mean, it's still very early stage, but, you know, we're seeing Novo build this presence in the space. So we've seen the outcomes data support a supplemental approval for Wegovy. That's also, you know, pending a approval in heart failure. We've got these other assets, which I talked about in terms of zelcovecumab. So it's really just kind of building out that portfolio in the space.
All right, so I'm asking for a friend here, Mikey. When is Novo Nordisk going to ramp up its production of this Wegovy and Ozempic and all that kind of stuff to meet demand? Because it's not even close yet.
Yeah, I mean, say Novo Holdings obviously did the deal recently. I mean, production's going to take time to ramp up. You know, 3 to 4 years before, you know, these sites come online. There's also limited capacity in the market as well. I think what's going to help kind of things, you know, longer term is, you know, the potential approvals of oral GLP-1s.
Ooh,
That should hopefully ease some of the, you know, some of the tight supply.
And what's the timing? What's the timing on that?
So 27, I would say that sort of time frame, 27, 28, possibly maybe a year earlier. There's several, you know, players that are developing oral GLP-1 drugs. So Lilly being one of them. We could see some data for Viking and Amgen's, albeit early data this year. But yeah, that could really be key to kind of opening up the market.
So are there also M&A opportunities or bolt-ons that Novo Nordisk could make to help expand capacity more quickly?
Well, they've done one deal already. And yeah, I mean, they're looking to invest to basically expand capacity going forward and support their GLP-1 portfolio. So it wouldn't surprise me if, you know, there are further deals or further efforts and investment into expanding their supply capacity.
All right, so Mikey, what are some of the, maybe the one or two big therapeutics or drugs or 2024 event here that are you guys are waiting on that if something hits, it's just gonna be big, whether it's in the world of cancer or if it's in the world of anywhere else in healthcare. What's kind of the big next big blockbuster that you think is reasonable to come out of the pharma industry?
I mean, 24 is all about weight loss and some of the comorbidities, to be honest. I mean, some of the data points that we're looking out for, it's going to be semaglutide MASH readout. So that's a liver condition. We're also expecting kind of detailed data from Boehringer and Zealand's survodutide in the same disease area. And then we'll also see details of Lilly's Zepbound in that liver condition too. You know, BC readouts are, you know, front and center again. So in terms of, you know, data, upcoming data sets, it's going to be Amgen's readouts for Amgen's assets. And as I said earlier, possibly some oral data for Viking's GLP-1 drug.
What do you make of the valuations for the likes of Novo Nordisk or any that are in the weight loss drug? Like, we have no idea how to value this. It's sort of like the AI phenomenon. How do you think about it?
Yeah, so when we look at, you know, Lilly and Novo, you know, they clearly stand out. Obesity, GLP-1s underpinning their growth prospects. You know, both have, well, Novo at least has, you know, a margin is up there with peers. But if we look at, you know, the obesity space, you know, in general, more than 100 million sufferers, GLP-1 penetration rates, you know, are very low at the moment. You know, we think access is going to improve, you know, as we see more data, as we see more benefits in comorbidities. And, you know, we're looking at a, or we're forecasting an obesity market size of, you know, $80 billion in 2030, which is looking quite conservative. And when we look at kind of penetration rates, that's based on, you know, just 12% of US patients being on a GLP-1 therapy. So there's significant runway there, you know, to support the valuations. And then there's also other markets which we, you know, haven't necessarily kind of fully factored in. So China, for example, could be a massive market for these drugs.
Our thanks to Michael Shaw, Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Pharma Biotech Analyst.
This is the Bloomberg Intelligence Podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live each weekday, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern, on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.